Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Everybody, welcome to this episode of Radio Labyrinth Presents. We have two awesome guests tonight. Two members of the Josh Joplin Group. They are Jeff Melkonian, who we had on the show before, a multi-talented musician who owns and operates Breadwinner Cafe in Sandy Springs and Dunwoody, and is the lead singer and guitarist for the amazing REM cover band, The Remakes. Plus, Josh Joplin, who is the lead singer and also a multi-talented musician, songwriter, and movie producer. He's the lead singer of the Josh Joplin Group. They're playing a slightly delayed 20th anniversary of Useful Music, Josh Joplin Group's debut record. It's a concert coming up at City Winery in Atlanta on April 23rd. And if you'd like to find out more about that, go to citywinery.com. By the way, I want to thank both of you for coming on the show. Josh Joplin and Jeff Melkonian. I want to say it right because I didn't say it right last night when we recorded. Jeff admonished me. Josh Joplin Group back together again for a show at City Winery that's coming up. And I think we would love to go to that show. And I don't care where we sit. I want to go.
I already got my ticket. So you're going to have to.
Look at you, Jeff Lebo.
Jeff's the man. Jeff got me into Josh a long time ago. He said, hey, you should come with me to go see Josh Joplin at Eddie's Attic in Decatur. And I said, okay. And I was hooked.
I think I might have put the first announcement up about the show a couple of weeks ago. And I kid you not, not even 3 minutes passed and I had a Facebook messenger from Leboff.
I want to go.
Yeah, I was probably one of the first tickets that sold.
You probably awesome. Were. Thanks, Jeff. And Jeff.
Tell everybody how you got started, because like Tim and I, you're from Pennsylvania originally, Josh.
Oh, you guys are from Pennsylvania?
Yes, we are.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, I'm from Lancaster. And where are you guys from?
Mansfield.
Yeah, we're both from Mansfield.
I didn't realize you were both from there. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So I got started coming from Lancaster. My family moved us to the suburbs of Baltimore. I used to say D.C. because I didn't want to claim Baltimore was the city we were really in the suburbs of.
Yeah.
And so I went to a really, really nice little Quaker private school. And by the time I'd gotten to the ninth grade, I dropped out of that school and I started a public school not too far from my house in Columbia, Maryland. And by the second or third week of the 10th grade, I dropped out of it and thought that I would be going to community college. I had this idea, maybe it's an idea that I just told my parents because it was the one way that they wouldn't disown me. But I thought I'd go to community college. But the truth is that my parents were kind enough from the time that I had dropped out of school to the time that I was going to go into my next chapter at community college, had sent me to Seattle. And so I went there and it just kind of gave me a new perspective. And I came back from that couple of months being out there, having learned to ride a motorcycle and having to figure it out. Like, I really liked playing. I just never went on to community college, and I bought a Volkswagen van, and I just basically tooled around the country for a couple of years, and that's kind of where that's how I made money for a while, was just playing on the streets, or I'd work odd jobs, especially as a dishwasher, as a busboy, and then I went to Denver, and then I went to New York, and when I went to New York, it was just impossible to stay there and live off of busking. And I was also really still too young to be in clubs, and all the clubs that I thought were in New York still, because I was naive and there was no Google, were all closed. I thought that they'd all be open and that I'd be able to play them. So it was actually Kevin Kinney's record that I heard about, and then I bought the vinyl of and everything, and I was like, okay, well, I guess there's folk singers in Atlanta, not knowing at all about Driving and Crying. And I'd actually met him probably 2 weeks into my first having arrived in Atlanta at a party that Jeff Clark was throwing, that T-Bone Burnett was playing.
From Stomp and Stammer?
Yeah, from Stomp and Stammer. And it was at his house. And I met Kevin, and it just dawned on me, like, oh, he's not like a topical folk singer. He's just a completely different thing. And what have I done? And it was a massive collapse of confidence. But I stayed.
Yeah,
and, it was fortuitous, obviously.
Yeah, Kevin's an interesting guy. I know him tangentially through my boss, who's friends with him, and he, my boss, directed the documentary "Scarred but Smarter."
Oh, sure, okay.
Driving and Crying, yeah. And yeah, a couple of years ago, we always do a Christmas show at the radio station WSB where we work, and Kevin and I did Bing Crosby, and we did that David Bowie thing with a twist. I was Bing, and he was Bowie. It was a lot of fun. But
oh, Kevin, he was Bowie. I was hoping he'd be Bing.
No.
A funny story. Sorry to interrupt.
No.
When we with Josh talking about all the folk clubs in New York, sometime after we made our first album, which what was that? It was 96, I think it came out, Projectorhead. We finally started doing some shows on the road, and our first date in New York ever was at the Bitter End. Remember, Josh?
Oh, absolutely.
And I didn't know the history very much, but Josh, of course, did. And he's like, oh, no, it's one of the most legendary. Dylan's played there, and Joni Mitchell, and it was so exciting to get to go
right
and play there. And is it on McDougal or on Bleecker, right? It's on Bleecker Street. And we get there and we play, and it's like they're shuttling like 15 bands a night through the place, and we got our 30 minute set, and we literally no sound check, and it's like we went on stage, we played our 30-minute set, and we were loading out and on the road an hour later.
it was another auspicious time for Josh Joplin Group.
Yeah, it was like that was our New York experience right there.
Tell us how you and Josh met up. Was it back when it was Josh Joplin Band?
Well, Josh and a gentleman named Jason Bucher and I started Josh Joplin Band, and Josh was playing solo at the time. We had a mutual friend who was an attorney in town named Drew Jackson, who it was a complete, you know, happenstance type of thing where I met Drew through another friend. And I, you know, was always into networking and whatnot back then. And we just got to talking, and he's like, well, I have a client who's looking to put a band together, and Jason, our original drummer, and I had done a lot of work together, doing sound production and studio stuff. And I said, well, I have a drummer too. And so we got together, we just met up, and Josh, had a demo of, three or four songs, including, I think, Weebles and I've Changed.
Oh, yeah.
And a couple other songs. And of course they sounded great, and we got together within the next week and just started playing together, and that was pretty much it. We started booking shows, and mm-hmm. Yeah, the rest was
originally a lot of history. The idea was that, because I got the notion to want to play with other people, and I was looking for people to play with, and I started actually a little band that did not come together with a very good, who is a friend, still a very good friend of mine, Ani Cordero, and I was living in Cabbage Town, I think, at the time. And so I had this notion to want to play with other people. I just didn't know very many other people. And also, I may be the only human being who's ever tried busking in Atlanta, Georgia. I did busk, and I played, I mean, I played down in underground, and I played in Midtown, and actually I played in Midtown and was given a job at the Rhino, if anybody remembers that. It was just a very, very short stint at there, and Sylvia's Atomic Cafe would have me play, because my playing was also very frenetic, and it was also born out of busking, so it was loud and boisterous, and it's probably still is to this day, because that's just how I came up. But I kind of feel like when I got to meet Jeff and Jason, they were sort of the first two people who allowed me to be what I was, and then try to like figure out where they fit into that, because I played all the time, and I've been, and so it was actually really, really nice, because the truth is that for the most part, everybody who wanted to start a band were, you know, collectively looking at like having a, you know, rock thing in mind, and I was too, but I just didn't even know what that really meant. Jeff, being the musician that he is, was capable, and Jason for that matter, were capable of like kind of becoming, you know, mentors to me and allowing me to like grow as a musician with them. And at the same time, I think that, you know, we didn't immediately say, oh, we'll be a band. It was just, why don't you guys play a few shows with me? And then, and then you guys came to me and said, hey, we'll do this again. And that was awesome, because it, you know, my first time around with playing with people, they were just like, dude, I don't know what to play with you. You're just, you know, I have no idea.
Where did you live in Cabbage Town? I'm curious.
I lived so Cabbage Town, I lived right off of Boulevard, and I lived in the white apartments that are right across the street from the graveyard there. And I lived under, we were just talking about this, I lived under the bass player for Smoke. So Benjamin constantly was upstairs, and Kelly Hogan lived not too far away from me, and Alan from Seersucker lived near. I lived in a whole community of really fantastic musicians, and definitely, especially when it came to Jody Grind and Kelly, that they were a huge sort of life-changing force for good in the world, but for my life, and seeing them and seeing 5/8 open for them at the Variety at their I think it was Lefties Deceivers release party. That's actually what made me really want to start a band, was seeing Mike Mancione.
What was the scene like back then in Atlanta? I moved here in 96, so
okay,
that kind of, we were going to clubs and just seeing different bands. Yeah. I think the band we always liked to go see was 17 Years, and then they became 6X. A lot of punk and different stuff like that, but we were going to everything.
Jeff, you and I probably saw different things then, but we also had things that we'd see in common too. 5/8 being a generally a band that I think we all felt like, yeah. Mike is just a next level songwriter and singer, and now that I know him, human being. So that's I know he was definitely somebody I'd like to see everywhere they were playing if I could. I worked a lot. I really did. I worked night shifts. I was a dishwasher in the morning, and then I was a dishwasher at night a lot. So for me, I would catch a lot of bands after, you know, like I would miss openers a lot. I saw a lot of bands at The Point. That was
I missed The Point. Oh my
God. Yeah, I would go to The Point, and I would go. Weirdly enough, I feel like I went I never really did like Five Star. I think I probably would have liked that more. That had like more of a Southern Gothic rockabilly raw thing going on. I actually like a lot of those bands, like Flat Duo Jets. I liked a lot. I thought they were really cool. I saw them a couple of times. I guess what you're asking about, it's like, it seemed like the scenes were bifurcated, like all scenes are, right? You know,
right.
Certain people who were doing, and I'm thinking right now of Jeff, who's David, we were just talking about him, who's playing with John Mayer now.
Follow For Now. Brand New Immortals, Follow For Now. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, those guys, that was like, honestly, it's kind of like Follow For Now was just the next level.
David Ryan Harris.
Next level experience. I was a big Uncle Green fan, so I watched them a lot. Jody Grind, if they played more, I would have seen them more. I tried to see them everywhere. And when I was the folk singer I was telling you I was at Sylvia's, Kelly was she was the cook there. Hmm. So not only was she this epic front person for this beautiful band, she was also just very, very nice and patient, certainly with my shenanigans, because I was definitely a topical folk singer in Atlanta. Right. I was all that and a bag of chips. So people who were just coming in for like their coffee, they were hearing, you know, I was like on Phil Oaks on methamphetamines.
I was kind of all over the place between, I did go, I probably saw more shows at The Point than anywhere else, because it was just honestly at the time the most solid venue in town for really seeing a showcase of any band. You know, back then, the Dark Horse had great shows down in the basement. I actually used to go see like random bands at like the Somber Reptile and places like that over by Tech. And but at the same time, I mean, and I've always been a huge fan of 5/8 too, and went, used to go see them all the time wherever they, and they played a lot.
They did.
But at the same time, I probably spent as much time going to Eddie's Attic and seeing Uncle Mark and seeing Caroline Aiken and hoping that an Indigo Girl would show up. So,
yeah.
You know, it was between, you know, quiet, be quiet acoustic and, you know, punk rock at the Somber Reptile.
Yeah.
That was such a great time for music, though. That era was just,
yeah, well, that was
in Atlanta.
Yeah, I mean, that, I think that's what I meant. It's like, so what was happening at Trackside didn't even make a difference to what was happening, like at the remnants of the 6088 people and all that time in Atlanta, because that those worlds, and I would say Amy Ray of Indigo Girls certainly had a lot more interest in rock and roll than maybe some of the others. But Trackside Tavern, and of course that was huge for me too, even though when I started there I was underage as well, so I always had to have a chaperone, and because Eddie had realized I was underage, so if I played Amy there, what's that?
Amy, even, I mean, through her label, I mean, she elevated she elevated so many bands and so many artists, totally. And it was like whatever the next thing that she put out there, which was always really great.
Yeah, like Damon Records did have its hand in a lot of that, stuff that was just kind of pulsing around, right. Maybe on the fringes of other stuff. So yeah, she's due a lot of credit for having very cool. And of course, Danny Beard with his label, I mean, he deserves a ton of credit. There's a lot of support, and I kind of came in at the heels of Swimming Pool Cues being sort of the A thing at one time, and maybe Uncle Green just more or less emerging, and Follow For Now and St. Jane. A lot of those bands, I'm sure, and Dada Id would have been like kind of the same space. Uh-huh. But when I was at Trackside, which was the sort of the first time I was really in a professional setting where there was actually microphones and monitors and all of those things, I met Sean Mullins on my very first night there, and he became a chaperone, and Natalie Farr became a chaperone, and unwittingly and probably very much to her objection, Kristen Paul became a chaperone. So like I had these people who had to make sure I didn't drink and I didn't come to the bar, and I just basically played. So to Eddie's credit, to my great gratitude to him for giving me a chance to even be in his place when I was not old enough to be.
The irony is you never drank.
I really am not a drinker.
I'm
really not. I mean, it's such a rare occasion that I even have a drink, as you have yours, and I have my can of like fancy Italian water. Like that's about as much as I'm doing. So he didn't have much to risk, but at that time too, I think like he whatever was happening in that scene was his baby, and like Indigo Girls, obviously, you know. I had no idea that they were going to be who they became, and they were already that by the time I arrived. I mean, they had already put out their, I guess that's their second record that is huge. And I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the title of it. It may just be Indigo Girls, but regardless, they had Closer to Fine on it.
Indigo Girls.
It's a classic.
That broke when we were freshmen in college, and you couldn't go anywhere on our campus without hearing it. This is Pennsylvania.
You still can, I don't think.
Oh, I know.
That's amazing. I'm a man of middle age, and I still think young people will have that somewhere in their catalog of things that they're going to listen to.
That's one of those records that's on my list that changed the trajectory of my being, honestly. It came out, I mean, I was just graduating from high school, and you couldn't stop listening to it. Nobody could. It didn't matter what you were into. I mean, hard rock, punk rock, didn't matter. That record was just encompassed so much.
Yeah, I'd play Dead Kennedys and then, you know, flip that over and put the
demo on. Awesome.
No, I mean,
you mean so like Jello Biafra onto Amy. Yeah, I understand that. Actually, I kind of was in the same, that was my headspace in many ways. Like, you know, I would say to this day, though, if someone, because, you know, obviously we are not international superstars, So when I explain, if I'm ever asked to, what were your favorite things? And I'll say that we had played with Indigo Girls, if that should ever come up, that almost inevitably is all I ever need to say. Everybody's just like, love them, love that record, have seen them play 1,000 times. They're also tremendous performers and people too.
So yeah, they are.
They're just incredible.
When we see them, Jeff, they opened for REM on the Green Tour, right? That's where
we saw
them.
That was the first time I saw them, yeah.
Yeah. First time we saw them.
Yeah, that was the first leg. I missed that leg. The second leg had Pylon, which was also great.
Oh, that's a great show. Wow.
But yeah, but it was Pylon in Knoxville. But yeah, that era, I mean, Magna Pop and Shrunken Head and...
Absolutely.
Yeah, all those guys. It was a fun time.
It really was. And there was so many... There was a band called The Quiet Men that I loved. Magna Pop was I was a huge Magna Pop.
Yeah, me too.
I should have even mentioned them because that I actually went to a ton of their shows. If they were playing, was it the Rec Room or anything that they did, I would try to find them. I really, really liked them a lot. I never got the chance to see Pylon. And to be honest, were they even playing at that time anymore? They probably were.
No, I thought they brought them back into playing to open that second leg of the tour. They were playing arenas,
Our drummer is Eric Taylor is a avid vinyl record collector, and I don't think he's still unsealed his Pylon box set.
I think he has two copies of
it's
it.
Like one, the Holy Grail.
One is sealed. And
don't even look at it. Kind of records.
Jeff, they were at that show at the Fox, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. Well, Vanessa sang. Yeah. Vanessa sang "Crazy" with REM.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
When you guys got going and got the band organized and started playing a lot, what was the first market? I'm going to assume it's Atlanta. What was the first market to get radio airplay? And I'm assuming that it's 99X and Leslie Fram. I want to know how much they helped you get out to a broader audience, if that's the case.
Definitely
Atlanta, yeah.
Yeah, I would say that the person that really gave us our first chance and championed us forever was Steve Craig.
Okay.
And we put out Projector Head at the beginning of 96, I think. And from the moment we put the record out, I think he was even at our show.
I think he was.
Introducing us and promoting us. And he had us on the Music Midtown Locals Only stage that year. And we had
for the year.
He put us on the Locals Only stage 3 times in the next 4 or 5 years and always, always championed whatever we were doing. And so I would without a doubt give Steve he was an integral part of us building our following as quickly as we did locally. Later on, Leslie certainly played a part in, 3 albums later and certain songs getting on the radio and whatnot. But I think by that point we had really had a solid Atlanta fan base in place already.
I've forgotten that he was very influential in that, and he had done the Locals Only. Yeah.
Yeah. Locals Only was just so, it had such a broad stroke between Music Midtown and the compilation CDs they put out and the Christmas shows. And I mean, it was just, for the most part, I think Steve had really great taste in music and he was very passionate about it. It wasn't, mm-hmm. he wasn't phoning that whole Locals Only thing in. It was his passion to do it.
Yeah, he showed up to shows. You know, the thing too, I think that early on when you woke up and it wasn't Power 99 or whatever it was supposed to be and it was this other thing.
Thank God.
Yeah, right? And it was this other thing. They were trying, I think, at that time to play, full on offense against the Georgia State radio station, 88.5, which was that was where, and we, and they played us as well, but we, but it, and that was, at that time, such a unique radio station and such an amazing, and played Pylon and played all, you know, Shrunken Head and played all of these other bands that, that we're just talking about, you know, and, including initially, you know, it would have been grunge and would have been post-punk and it would have been all of those things. But Steve, I think that show probably was run by Jeffrey Clark early days. Yeah. But I think once 99X, because obviously he ran the station at Georgia State, I think. And early days, it was clear that Steve really liked live music. And that was kind of welcome in, I think, for a lot of people, because the radio station hadn't been a format yet. There was no alternative music at that time, which is hard to fathom, because what was about to come was a clear channel and a whole monolith of radio stations that eventually, you know, Leslie helmed.
Yes. Now, when you brought up album 88, isn't the replacement song Left of the Dial about that station?
I think that's what I've heard. I mean, we'd like to all claim it, right?
Yes.
That's what they're talking about.
I think you're correct.
Meanwhile, there's like a radio station in Idaho that's claiming the same thing.
That's ours.
Yeah, that one's about KABC.
What prompted the change to the Josh Joplin Group? Was that just a tax thing?
Yeah, I think it was mostly, well, I think mostly I, and this sounds very self-serving, I was very uncomfortable being Josh Joplin Band. I was uncomfortable being Josh Joplin Group. And I did try to change our name, and I think Jeff would back me up on this. I had wanted to change our name because I wanted to be a band. And then when Jason and Jeff and I parted ways, and Alan was in, and we had for a moment Ani Cordero, and then for the duration of the next several years, Eric. I guess that's kind of was the change that we made. My idea was the Jarvis 5000, I want to say, was one of my band names for us.
Royal know, Norman.
What's the other one?
Royal Norman.
Royal Norman. So anyhow, what had happened was that I think we'd already sort of had this like thing. Jeff and everybody else were right. You know, I don't even know if Jeff was probably pretty open to changing things, but you know, the idea was, why would you do this? You're known as this thing. And, you know, for me, Josh Joplin's just a name I chose for the alliteration. And because my friends, when I was, 15 years old and I was getting up on stage and they heard that I was, you know, being introduced as Josh Blum, they were like, man, you've really got to, you know, do something about that name. It's terrible. And so I chose another name, and I go over to my friend and I said, hey man, I've got a new name. And my friend says, oh, okay, great. What is it? And I said, it's Josh Jaffe. And he said, but that's even worse. Said, first of all, that's not a good name because that's also the last name of the girl you pine for in some ridiculous, unrequited love scenario, who's you're going to now take on her name. I mean, like, institutionalize me at this point. So he actually said, why don't you call yourself Josh Nixon? And I said, oh, I don't know. That's kind of cool. And then we just hammered out Josh Joplin. And so for me, it's stuck, and I'm happy in a way that it did, but like by the time we got to be Josh Joplin Group, I know that I did try to change our name many times.
Didn't Josh Joplin, that whole sequence and conversation of your new stage name happen in a matter of like 2 minutes backstage before you went on? Like That whole conversation happened right as he went on stage.
So. Yeah, yeah. It was, the conversation was literally like a 2 minute, like, oh my God, you're about to be Josh Blum on stage.
Like, you fine, it's Joplin. I'm going on.
Yeah, it's Joplin. Here we go. And then I was like, oh, yeah, it's got some reverb to it. Oh, yeah.
So to add to what Josh was saying about to Jeff's question of the huge change from band to group, it also happened right around the same time that we signed our record deal. And I think we were getting a lot of,
was this when you were with Network?
No, this is when we were with Network. We were with Network for about 10 minutes and then we weren't. Network being a management company, not a
yeah, they were the label for like Bare Naked Ladies and
we were never on Network Records. We were for a minute working with a manager with Network.
Oh, okay.
It didn't work out, but
they had two things going on simultaneously.
Right. And there was, we just were not, it was at the same time that
manager sucked.
Bare Naked Ladies.
That's what it was.
Bare Naked Ladies and
evil human being. That's what that was. But he went on to have some success with a little band we call Coldplay.
Yeah.
So
he's only Coldplay's manager now.
Yeah, I'm sure he's huge. I applaud myself when I forget people's names, especially like this. And I can't remember his name, so I don't want to be reminded, Jeff, if you remember it. But I am like, that was like a nightmare scenario.
It was. It was a nightmare. It was a couple months where we just were in this no man's land with it. But we were also... Yeah. To whoever brought it up, whoever's point, we were lost between Bare Naked Ladies and Sarah McLachlan, and it was a very small management company that managed these two huge artists, and we were all of a sudden on this roster, but we got lost. So, but anyway, no, this was when we signed with Artemis, and I think between the label and our manager Russell, and it was, there was a lot of pushback to say, no, we're not. This is not the time to throw away the name that has been built up in a lot of these markets. And we, you know, it was, while it was a band, it was also a band that was fronted by a very, you know, powerful front person. It wasn't the right time to make that change. And so I think the idea of changing it to something like what was it? 5,000.
It was the Jarvis 5,000.
Jarvis 5,000 or Royal Norman was not the right
Royal
time.
Royal Norman. That was another one.
It was the Royal Normans.
Okay. The Royal Normans.
Yes. I think that's what it was.
That sounds right.
So anyway,
that it was in a nod to Patti Smith. That was, we were like, oh, okay, well, Patti Smith group, Josh Joplin group. Yeah. So that, I think maybe somebody talked me into that intelligent comparison.
And this was around the same time that some TV shows started picking up your music, like Scrubs and Northern Exposure, Party of Five. Yeah.
Dawson's Creek, please don't forget
Dawson's that. Creek.
Dawson's Creek,
phenomenal. We were actually, it's funny because I get the ASCAP stuff occasionally, and I'll let you know what shows. And there's some shows that I never got to see, but I wanted to see Roswell and the episode we were in the most because apparently it's. It's an episode where a vampire is killed but then comes back to life. So, you know, we were mostly chosen for the high art stuff. Yeah. Our episode of Dawson's Creek, if you're interested, is Promicide.
That's right. Promicide.
That happened.
I don't remember the name of the Scrubs episode
that one I don't know, but I know that's actually been Zach Braff has been very kind in that he really is clearly a music fan. I don't know him. I don't know if anybody around me knows him, but he's always been very generous in getting all the musicians, no matter how big or small they are. He seems to always give them a kind of a generous nod of I think he makes sound like he's made playlists that have included us, and it was very nice. So I'd like to thank Zach Braff and his team and Promicide.
I don't remember the name of the episode of Scrubs, but I can tell you that it was 30 seconds of camera one being played while they were tossing around a urine sample from.
Oh my God. Oh, I just found the scene on YouTube.
Yeah, that's the scene.
And then you guys got to play on Letterman and Conan and some other shows.
Yeah, we got to play. Actually, it's funny. We got to play on really the big late night shows. So that was exciting and really nerve wracking because you're growing up. Certainly, I grew up watching Letterman, you know, and to see and I don't know how you felt, Jeff, but for me, you know, to see that band in the, you know, and that Hammond and, you know, and that in the corner of your eye as you're performing was very nerve wracking.
So when we did Letterman and Letterman for me was well before I knew Josh, my musical goal in life was to play on Letterman. And
it's awesome. I didn't
know that. So fast forward to when we found out we were going to be on Letterman maybe less than a week prior to then. And we were on tour opening for Matthew Sweet for about 6 weeks at the time, and we happened to be up in we were touring the Northeast in the winter, which made a whole lot of sense. we had to cancel a date to do Letterman, but the night before we were in Buffalo. And we had to get to New York City by load-in was at 9 o'clock in the morning for Letterman. And so we had to drive from Buffalo to New York overnight in the snow. And it was, you talk about the most, like, to me, that was more nerve-wracking than actually doing this show. Because our crappy little van at the time and trailer, and it was like, oh my God, what are we going to get here? And so, it ended up being, you know, a career highlight for me, and I'm sure for Josh too, but I'll never forget and to Josh's point, it was truly one of the most nerve-wracking experiences, just getting to that point of playing the song and then getting to the end of the song because of everything that's at stake and whatnot. But there was a moment afterwards, I don't know if Josh remembers, but Josh and I ended up, you had to take an elevator from the stage back down to the green room or back up to the green room. And somehow Josh and I ended up by ourselves in that elevator right when the song was like a minute after the song was over. And we just got in there and we just like hugged it out. And we were like, I cannot believe that just happened. And of course we get back to the green room and there was a little bit of celebration, but that anticipation of being on a late night show of that caliber for the first time was pretty incredible.
It was definitely fun.
Yeah.
And then I'd gone on to do so what had happened is we would do tours together, and then our label would send me out to do more. So like as much as we were touring, I would do other things, and I ended up we got to do a bunch of other like appearances and for all of the appearances we did, I would say that the one that stands out for me and us was Conan because I didn't watch him at the time, but he was the nicest person. And Deeds, our guitar player, their amp blew up. And he personally went into, like he was gonna go into his office, he's an avid guitar player, and find another amp for us to use. Like, this is the host. Do you remember all that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and he also,
He also like, what is this man? He is like next level.
He
like,
was next level.
I love him so much.
He came into our dressing room prior to the show, and or I don't remember if we had sound check yet or not, but he came into our dressing room with his acoustic guitar, and he's like, "Come on, I want to play camera one with you real quick. Let's do this."
Wow.
But
he was as nice as any person could ever be, and then you're just like, oh, you know, you love him on his show, but then for him to, you know, live up to all that and then beyond that was just, that was a highlight. I think
that
was my biggest highlight
ever. Josh, I don't know if you remember this, but afterwards the best part, one of the best parts of that whole Conan experience, and you Labyrinth guys will love this, but so of course it's, you know, downstairs from Saturday Night Live, and it was, we taped on Friday, and J-Lo was hosting Saturday Night Live that weekend, so there was a lot of buzz around the building. Rachel Dratch was on the show that we were playing.
Yeah, she was a guest.
It was Rachel Dratch and Al Roker.
Wow.
And it's like Al Roker. Yeah, it was like, wait a minute, we don't have any
guests
tonight. Like, who can we get in the NBC building to be on the show tonight? We got Al Roker and we got Rachel Dratch. Let's get them. Yeah. And, but what was great about it with Rachel Dratch on the show was that afterwards, the entire SNL cast came down.
Right.
They came down to see the show, and they stayed afterwards. And there was a good hour there of hanging out with Will Ferrell and Jimmy Fallon and Maya Rudolph and Anna, like that whole crew that go look up the cast from 01. That was who was down in the hallways of the after party of the Conan show that night.
Which says a lot about Rachel Dratch too, doesn't it? Like how awesome she must be, because she was also next level, kind, nice. I saw her years later at the airport, and I said, we work together. And she laughed, and I was sort of just teasing, obviously, but I had to, of course, remind her of this auspicious moment. But it was fun nonetheless, and she is just a very, very it was, you know, the whole cast is coming to see her, so she, and clearly somebody everybody loved.
She was funny. That whole cast that
was a good cast.
Late 90s, early 2000s peak for Gen Xers, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, you look up the cast from 01, and every one of them was down there, and it was, and everybody was having conversations and talking and having fun. You know, like, we were starstruck, of course, but it was very cool.
So you guys have the show coming up. You guys already started rehearsals. How are they going?
We did.
And it's they're going well. I have so I play in a band that's kind of a collection of all kinds of people, and we don't play a lot right now. I hadn't played obviously with Jeff, Alan, and Eric in all of these years, but I was looking forward to being able to just hear what we sound like again, sort of for the first time. And I was really, really, it's just so much fun, because we always stayed friends. All of us have stayed friends. So in a way it's a reunion of musicians, of course, but of friends. Jeff and I talk all the time to this day, even if we're not doing this show. And I try to see him if I'm in Atlanta. He's come to New York to see me. And that goes for Eric, who we didn't see as much because he lived in Africa, but Alan, and even Deeds stay in touch with. It was quite nice. I don't know how you felt, Jeff, but I enjoyed myself.
No, it was great. You know, we Josh drove in from New York last week, and Eric lives in Spartanburg now, and Alan and I are both in Atlanta, and so we converged on Alan's house, and Alan has a little studio space, and that first day, I mean, it was personal, you know, personality wise, everything fell into place. We were laughing from the second we got there. And then musically, it was a bit rusty at first.
Is that because you're playing bass and you're not used to that?
I mean, no, it wasn't that. I mean, we all still play music. It's just, it was like, there was just little thing. There was just little things that were like, oh boy, that didn't quite sound right.
It's the first day of any rehearsal for anyone.
That's all. Yeah.
It really is like, you know, it's like coming out of and sort of feeling everybody out again, yeah, and get an understanding like, oh yeah, that's right. So for me, what I was going to start with is that I've been playing, I haven't been playing many live shows for several years, but I've been playing these songs now. I continue to go on and play these songs. And so I was changing them along the way, and I would play with other bands and we would just play to my changes probably. So a little bit too of it is just coming back and learning the songs the way we played them, and so being on the same page about that is like multiple emails later. Like, I'll get that email.
That may or may not have been good.
And then finally, by I'd say the second day for sure, everything kind of fell back into a nice place. But the best thing about it is that we all get along and we all like each other.
Josh might have said a few times along the way, did you read any of my emails with the No, but Josh and I were talking for a while on the phone yesterday, kind of recapping the weekend, and we rehearsed Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and really by Friday we ran the set list each day, some songs more than others, but by the second day we were starting to gel again, there's getting through the song and knowing our instrumental parts, but you know, Josh and Alan and I have, I don't know if there's a song that doesn't have three-part harmony on it, and we spent a lot of time sussing through the harmonies and trying to remember who sang, especially Alan and myself, trying to remember who sang what, which harmony, and going back to the records and finally just figuring out what worked best. And honestly, in 20 years, like, our voices have changed a little bit too. And, you know, Josh can't hit certain notes. I can't hit certain notes. Alan, you know, so it's just, so we started to kind of rework some of those harmonies, but by Saturday, the third day, it was really starting to come together. And I feel like we all left feeling confident that the next round of rehearsals will be will be even better. So we're going to do another round in March and then in April when we play.
Yeah, 2 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're looking forward to the show very much.
Yeah, we are too.
Yeah.
I'm going to see if I can bring my dad. It's his birthday. I don't know. He'll go, who are they? Oh, gosh.
My mother is going to be there, so you know it's going to be a family friendly show. Well, I think my mother's going to be there, but that's
you do any Merle Haggard covers?
I wish I did. No, I don't. You should not bring your dad.
How about Phil Oakes? Do you do any Phil Oakes covers? I've seen you do them.
I can definitely do Phil Oakes covers. So yeah, you could just, in the back of his mind, if he's into Phil, he can just know that, hey, that guy up there that's singing all those non-Merle Haggard and non-Phil Oakes tunes can at least do Phil Oakes tunes. Yeah. Those songs I can probably play.
There's anyone that can do them.
Did you guys ever have any covers that you guys, you know, had in the set?
On the single for Camera One, I think I do There But For Fortune. But that's I don't think we did that as a band, but it is because our... we were on a very storied label, maybe not storied at that time, but it is now a storied label because it's Artemis Records, and it was founded by Daniel Glass and Danny Goldberg, who are both extraordinary executives in the music industry. Danny being a man, a publicist first, a very famous publicist and a very famous manager, managed at Nirvana among so many others. And he and I actually very much bonded. And his father, as a matter of fact, Victor Goldberg, we were all bonded over Phil Oakes. And so he had asked if I would do a cover of a Phil Oakes song. And I think, oh, you know what? It was Half a Century High. That was it. Mm. So I did a Half a Century High. And the debate was, do There But For Fortune or do Half a Century High. But that is a cover associated with us. My very first single, I was on a little punk label in DC, for my frenetic guitar playing and all that. I did, I Ain't Marching Anymore. I did a version of that too. So I've done Phil Oakes, but covers, we did Ray of Light once or.
Yeah, we,
oh wow.
We rarely did covers.
Rarely did covers.
And we did Ray of Light a few times, which was always, we kind of melded into a couple other songs, but it always worked.
Yeah.
We did go into a good 120 beat per minute dance beat for it, and it always worked with the crowd. We did several times the Smiths Big Mouth Strikes Again.
Oh yeah, that's true.
We did Sticks Come Sail Away a couple times.
Nice. I cannot imagine we did that.
We did it. Once Alan joined
the Who, we did a Who song.
But once Alan joined the band and we had the piano, he started playing Come Sail Away at shows, and we only did it a couple of times.
You may have also done Dream Weaver too. I like the idea that I can't remember us doing Sticks, but I like the idea that we did. That's impressive.
Well, now,
and that we might have done Dreamweaver, because that's how bad my memory is now.
We
could say we did. Oh yeah, we did that tune. I'd be like, oh, we did. That's amazing.
I mean, we rarely
that drive from Buffalo though.
Yeah. Oh God, that was awful. We rarely did covers. We did.
That's true. We didn't do covers, and for poor Jeff, I was a songwriting machine. So I did not ever, like, I was never one of those songwriters that had an issue writing lots and lots and lots of songs. And even listening back to our very first couple of records, I realized, oh well, I wrote songs, but I didn't actually finish some songs. But we would record those songs just the same. Or, like, now I would think, oh, you know, you need to do a bridge. I wrote most of my songs didn't have bridges when we first got together. But I wrote hundreds of songs for a time. And then as we did more, I began to write songs that I would take a lot more time on. And now I would say I probably still write, you know, a healthy amount of songs, but it's just a different process. And I like to spend more time on them.
I mean, you're not shoved in a studio by a movie producer saying you've got 3 weeks to record Let It Be and then perform it on top of it.
Yeah, no.
I learned so much about the process from that 8-hour documentary.
Yeah, exactly.
Why don't we say, is it in Tucson? It's Tucson, a city in Arizona. Yes. Okay, we'll say that then.
Yeah, I loved it.
Plug your new project.
The show.
And Jeff, you can plug your other band and your business and stuff, and then we'll let you guys go.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. So I still play in Among the Oak and Ash, and we are going to be putting out another record. So that's a band that I play with all kinds of people, but our first record was with Garrison Starr, and it's kind of the guys who played, they played with Shelby Lynn and Emmy Lou Harris and a bunch of other Nashville legendary folks. And then
I saw you guys at Smith's Old Bar.
Oh, good. Okay, good. And so there is that. And then I play in a project with a friend of mine who is a producer in Brooklyn named Lorenzo Wolf. And we have a record called Gap Year. As a matter of fact, I think, I mean, this is just for you guys. We actually had just got this in, like, literally, like, this is the vinyl for Gap Year. It just came in, like, today. I'm just pulled this back here. But, yeah, so that is a record that we were super excited to put out and record right before 3 years of COVID. So it's like, we have not played a show. We've not done anything. We just have... We have a piece of vinyl that no one will ever buy because they've never heard of us. So that's my two cents. But hopefully he and I were going to make another record together. We'll see if that actually happens. But I'd like to do something more. And so that's my musical present, meaning to bring you to the present,
right.
Not my gift.
Do we have to write you a thank you note for that present?
Please.
I will. I have a bunch of restaurants called Breadwinner and Breadwinner Cafe and Farm to Ladle here in Atlanta, but that's boring.
It's super cool.
It's fun. It's great. It's become awesome. It's become my career post music, and it's I do enjoy it quite a bit. Right now I'm working on I've got a band out of Athens that it's a fun project called The Bad Ends, and it's what started out as a Mike Mantione solo record. Mike from 5/8, who's one of my closest friends, and he we've been putting off the solo record for almost 20 years since we produced the 5/8 Black record and the next record, so anyway we're doing a project together called The Bad Ends. It's Mike, it's Bill Berry from REM, it's Dave DeMeese, it's and a guy named Christian Lopez, and honestly it started out as a two-song project to kind of help get Mike's solo record off the ground, and it turned into a full band, like a partnership band type thing, and with publishing and with and we signed a deal with New West Records earlier this year and or late last year, and the record's coming out in September. It's called The Power and the Glory, and we're excited about it. Similar to Josh's story, it all happened pre-COVID, and then I mean, we mastered the record in December of 19 and then sat there in February and said, all right, here's the game plan. And then, of course, it all shut down.
Yeah.
And we had the luxury of we didn't wait 25 years to remaster our record. We just 2 years later, we remastered it. We sat there and listened to it for 2 years while it didn't come out. So we just remastered the record. It's coming out in September on New West on vinyl and digital, and I think CD as well, and so we're really excited about that.
That's awesome. Are you guys gonna play out anywhere?
I don't know yet. I hope so. I think, you know, I'm the second youngest guy in the band at 52 years old, and you know, it's incredible that a group of guys between the age of 50 and 63 got a record deal. And and so
these days, yeah, definitely
it is. Yeah, it's crazy. And so we I don't know, we'll see. I mean, there's so many other ways to get the music out there now, and I'm not sure if we're going to jump in the van and start doing shows, but I have a feeling it'll be more specialty shows, especially things that have a broad reach, like a mountain stage or things like that. Of course, Radio Labyrinth, and
yes, you will get such a bump. You're going to get the biggest, hugest bump.
We'll see. I mean,
why they got signed. Was more or less because you guys have committed to having them.
Did I dropped it? I said there's. I said we'll absolutely get on the show, and the deal is done.
Guys, thank you so much for coming on. it's a treat, definitely a treat. And I wanted to say to Josh, we touched on it a little bit, and I've tried to ask you about this before, but I was always too, you know, shy or whatever at the concerts. But just Phil Oakes is one of those artists I discovered in my mid to early 20s, and was a very profound lyrically and vocally. I love his voice. I love the way he played. And it was always sad to know that, oh, I'll never be able to see this person in concert. So I did get to see you perform one of his songs. So that was always a treat for me. But just the song, Tape from California, no matter when I hear it or put it on, it just gets inside of me. And like a lot of his songs do. But, you know, I just wanted to thank you for being somebody that keeps him in the, you know, alive in a way. So that's all.
Thanks for saying that. And he is definitely alive with me, and I still listen to his music, and certainly same thing. It's just like he has a place in my growth as a person. And and you know, when your hero is somebody that didn't have a happy life, it also takes a bit of a toll on your outlook. But there was something in his music too, though, that just shed so much hope and
yes,
created this other space that that I guess it made it feel you know, he had always said to turn away from the machinery, that was something he would say, and to turn away from the machinery and just build anew. And that's kind of what his music did in a way. And even if it was his own internal struggles, his right, music was a way of seeing something beautifully hopeful and new.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I've read it, and I'll shut up after this, but sometimes I read he was just a basic protest singer and stuff, and there's just so much more to him than that, and the song structures and the words, it's not all just protest, and it's hope, and yeah, you can be happy and, you know,
yeah,
and playful too, some of his songs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely.
This is great, and you guys are welcome to come on anytime. You have anything to plug, or just let Jeff know, and we'll plug it. Definitely a treat.
That's really, thank you so much for having us.
So the show is at City Winery on April 23rd. City Winery, awesome venue to see a show. Very intimate. You know, they have wine, and and you can get tickets at citywinery.com. And it looks like it's selling well too. So I'm gonna have to get mine. And tomorrow I'm going to go up to Steve Craig and say, hey, I spoke to some friends of yours last night, because I see him every day.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, please send him our best. Certainly mine. Jeff may not have those feelings. I don't know. Just, but I speak on behalf of myself.
I'm the one Steve texts about the show. So, you know.
You're the one what?
I'm the one he texts about the show.
So. He did. Okay. He doesn't text me. Yeah. I'll text Jeff.
We're looking forward to the show at City Winery, and let us know if you ever let any spectators come and watch some of the rehearsals before the show.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you guys so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.